Accession number 32390, Harold Checkets, row 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Checkets?
Yes, I was actually born in Peopleton, near Pershaw, Worcestershire, on the 2nd of March 1920.
And could you just give us an outline of your background before you came to work at, you know, in the meteorological office?
Yes, well, I was brought up on a farm at Walcott, near Pershaw Station, and I lived there from when I can first remember, which was when I was about 3. It was in the next house up the road before that, and I was brought up on the farm with my father and uncle, and it was a tenant farm, so we were paying the rent all the time in difficult times. And I remember the 1920s and the difficulties in the 1920s. You know, I was a child who was very fond of his father, and I used to go around with him so often on the farm that I got to know it as if it was going to be my job, which probably in the very first place it was going to be. I was going to inherit the job of being a farmer there at Walcott Farm. But when I was 10, I gained a scholarship to the King's School in Worcester, and gradually sort of got immersed in scholarship, really, I suppose, and learning, and eventually ended up at the age of 18 at Bristol University, where between 1938 and 1940 I qualified, because I'd done 2 years there. When I was called up for the Navy, I qualified for a BA degree in modern languages.
Now, so tell us what happened when you were called up.
quite interesting things, really. I remember being called up in Bristol and being a bit hesitant about which queue I should join, whether it would be the Army, Navy or Air Force. And eventually I went across to the naval queue and joined that. And I was then interviewed and also given a medical, and you know, passed all right. And the assumption was always, because of my educational background, that I would immediately plump for a commission as an officer, which I, for, you know, I don't know why, but I never particularly craved that sort of promotion. All through my life I've been the same, really. I've never wanted limelight particularly. I've never wanted the highest positions. And so it was left that I joined the Navy and went through the ordinary training as a seaman. And the next thing I knew was that I was off to Ganges, and I trained in Ganges. And there were so many things about Ganges that were similar to the farm, my farming background, which was one of great cleanliness, partly because we kept milking cows. And so everything had to be spotless in dairy and clothing and everything. And I went through Ganges for 10 weeks.
So when, do you know what dates you were there?
Yes, I started there on the 29th of... was it June or July?
That's
Can
right.
I look at my... I probably have put that down. You know, I've little things I can't remember very well. It must have been July, because it was the beginning, really almost the beginning of the Battle of Britain, which took place overhead when I was in Ganges quite a lot of the time. and there were all sorts of things to do, like going right up the mast, and quite exciting things.
You were training as an ordinary seaman?
Training as an ordinary seaman.
Oh, well, no specialisation at that
point? No specialisation at all. And I greatly enjoyed life with the other fellows in the same experience in Ganges, in the hut. I remember it well. And I remember the exercises that we had to do, and including the bayonet stabbing of sort of sacks, you know, with wrapped around to look like people, hoping that I would never be called on to do that, because that would have absolutely horrified me. I expect, like everyone else, I would have done it, but I didn't like the idea of it. And so it's the end of 10 weeks. I qualified as an ordinary, you know, I was sent off as an ordinary seaman, and was with a great big contingent, because they were already, listed this big contingent to join a particular battleship, which we gradually found the name of. And it was down to Devonport, which was quite exciting, because by then the raids had begun on places like Devonport, German raids, air raids. And I remember two or three things very vividly down there. When I was in Devonport barracks, I had two or three jobs. I saw a lot of the 50 American destroyers, and one of them I had the job of helping to clean out from down. You had to go down into the bowels of the ship, into these bilges, which were very tiny, and the job was, of course, to get into each of these little cubicles and mop out all the oil that was still swilling around in there, put it into buckets, and it would be hauled up top. A very dirty job. We did that in the middle of in the night, and not on night watches.
So you were just waiting at Devonport. For the Prince of Wales to arrive.
Yes, and also while in Devonport, HMS Javelin came in a very bad state with some bodies still on board. That was Lord Mountbatten's ship that had got into some rather unfortunate scrape with the Germans. And there were one or two other things, but I think those are the most important that I remember.
Do you remember any bombing of the Devonport while you were there?
Oh yes, there was bombing, all right. That was in fact the other thing, and we had to help clear up the streets, sweep up the glass and things like that, because it really started in earnest down there, I think. I don't know what was going on in other places. But that impressed itself on me. And then this whole group of people, we often went around together in working parties, even in Devonport. We all got shipped up to Bristol to wait at what was then, or had been, what's called Muller's Orphanage. And it had been converted into a kind of large hostel for a lot of our people who are eventually going to join the battleship. Hundreds of us. One or two experiences I remember there very vividly. One of them was that I nearly got electrocuted, because in the washroom there were lamp brackets up above, and unfortunately I slung my wet clothes over the top of one and didn't loose it at the same time, and I was hanging there being electrocuted for some time before someone managed to rush in quickly and knock me clear. But that was quite a shock. I remember that quite well. And then, of course, eventually, after not a very long time, It was, I think, the end of January. We all were taken up to, was it Birkenhead, to be able to join the Prince of Wales.
Now, what was the first impression the ship made on you?
Well, it was an immense, monstrous creature, really. I remember seeing it in dry dock, because there were all sorts of things going on. The colour of it and the length of it, and in a dry dock, of course, it's somehow more impressive than when it's afloat. So I do remember that very well, and I remember the depth of the dry dock. You know, you had to walk around this very deep, you know, I wouldn't have liked to have been drunk in the dark approaching it. It was a very impressive ship.
And it was Birkenhead, you think you joined her at?
I think it was Birkenhead. That, you know, so many names occur to one during life, and of course at my age I do get
they can,
mixed.
They can look it up.
Yes.
Right. So how did you fit in? I mean, was the ship being repaired then?
Oh, the ship was being completed.
Completed,
really.
You're the first.
Yes,
crew,
oh, there were people still aboard doing welding and various other things there. And of course there were the other fittings to come, like I suppose the radar and lots of things being added to it. And then of course there was provisioning ship, which we had to help to do ourselves. And then finally we were let in on board. And I remember going into this, I think it was now mess, what was it? I was on the starboard side of the ship with about eight other men, and I remember the names of several of them now. You know, the killick of the mess was a chap named Yeomans, and I got on very well with him because he came from not too far away. He came from beyond at Newent, Ledbury, in the Ledbury area. And another reason why I got on well with him, he didn't write very well, and so he got me to write his letters to his girlfriend. So I had that job aboard. And of course, one of the first things I remember having to do was to sling the hammock, grab a space for a hammock, and sling your hammock so that you didn't bump all the time into the lockers, which went quite high up. A tiny little area for our mess, and all, of course, was metal all round you, pipes and metal, and also there was a porthole there, where but of course you didn't yourself let open it or anything like that. There was an enormous amount to learn, and of course the most important thing to learn was how to respond really to the pipes that came over, pipes for wakey wakey, rise and shine, and that was the first one, and you responded to that pretty quickly or else you were in trouble. I mean, at first it seems that everything you didn't do, you'd be in trouble for not doing. But it didn't turn out like that. And we had two or three old hands at that time on the mess. This one, and we had another old hand from down in Plymouth, who lived in Plymouth, I think. And then we had an Irishman, and they were all killicks. They got the two chevron badges.
Leading seamen.
They were all leading seamen, yes. And they were very helpful, really. They put us wise to so many things, if you listen to them, before you got into trouble, really.
And what were your duties aboard the ship?
My duties were particularly, in a sense, almost cushy. I had, presumably because of my background and war degree, although the ordinary people wouldn't have known that, and I didn't talk about it, but I did get what I call cushy numbers, in a sense. I mean, as a seaman, I was a member of a picket boat's crew. Our picket boat's crew, which took the higher officers to this place or that later on. And of course, I realise now that that I'm I don't know when we were nominated for these jobs, but of course it wasn't all that long before the ship moved up to Scapa Flow. You know, it was able to be the dry dock was became wet, and it was floated up to Scapa Flow, which strangely enough I had a great liking for. I loved Scapa Flow.
Why? What's it good
because
about?
There were so many things. Partly, we had a captain, Leach, who made sure, as he must have enthused the others to do it, that you told the rest of the ship's company what was going on up top. You know, I mean, there we were in the heat down below, and it was hot. And they never solved that, really, quite honestly. It was always hot down below, and so people used to take an opportunity of going up for a breather whenever they could. But if there were some particular kind of ducks, or you know, the Great Northern Diver, or the Northern Lights, or lots of other things, someone would pipe and say that these things, you know, you gradually got to find out when these things were around anyway, or maybe a shoal of mackerel, or you know, things like that. And so I didn't mind the cold, because I'd always liked cold weather, and I loved Scapa, and I loved going ashore in Scapa Flow, and meeting other people, and going for walks, and having a drink. Of course, having a drink had the main purpose when you walked across the island or whatever. So I was one of the few people who really liked Scapa Flow. And being on the picket boat, of course, for quite a while, I was going backwards and forwards to pick up stores or whatever, or pick up officers or ratings, or you know, whenever there was a job needed doing. But that ended with my getting my my legs crushed. My own fault, really, because I didn't move out of the way when the rather impetuous chap who was in charge of this picket boat swung it round and hit the rear of a drifter, and my legs got caught in between.
How badly injured?
Quite badly injured, yes, and no bones broken, but of course it twisted my legs, from which I've suffered actually since. I mean, I've never claimed or anything like that, but I know jolly well what caused it. And there was a wound on the back of my knee, you know, the back of your leg, and it took months to heal. They tried everything. I remember they tried permanganate of potash, they tried poultices, they tried cod liver oil, which made me smell every time I walked around like a fish. And that was still there, and still I was still limping, and you know, I had to go to sick bay with that, of course, and was in there for a week or two, and then I came out again and started doing my ordinary duties. Now, that was I'm talking about the seamanship one so far.
Now, what were those duties?
Well, the seamanship, of course, was ordinary jobs quite often when you fell in, or when you got fell in and reported for duty. You didn't know exactly what you were going to do, but being a picket boat's crew, of course, that predominated for me until I lost the job after my was with the other ratings. Now, the other job, the gunnery job for me, was in the forward transmitting station, another sort of what you might call cushy number that I'd fallen for. And of course, I've only really recently realised that I suppose there was something about my record or whatever that made them choose me for lots of things that otherwise I think I wouldn't have got.
So what were your duties in the forward transmitting station?
Well, the duties there were to receive the information. The gunnery officer was there, usually, and receive the information on a machine or for a machine coming from range finders and in fact radar and lots of ways of elevation and degrees left, right and so on. The information coming down would be plotted on these machines, which were made of glass, and you wound little handles to make sure it had got what was the information was being sent accurately on these machines. And of course, all that would be transmitted back to the guns for possibility of firing. So we were regularly. When other people were called up for other things, the transmitting station and gunnery people called in together, to do practices. And so you repeatedly doing practices, not really any more than anybody else on the mess for something, who had other jobs. But it was a very interesting job. It was right down in the bottom of the ship, of course, and so I got to know the people down there as a little, the crew of the. There were about six, I suppose, people down there in the main, with the gunnery officer, and then we the first thing you do on a ship like that, which is so brand new, you have to work it up to be. Acceptable as a sea-going ship.
Now, where did you the working up exercises?
To do the working.
At Scapa.
At Scapa and around. Yes. We did, of course, do quite a lot of moving out, not very far, say, or little manoeuvres in relation to other people, and. So assume that we've worked up and to state that was sort of acceptable or almost. It was declared that we were ready to join the fleet. Strangely enough, on the very day that the Bismarck was reported to be out of its. Well, I'd forgotten which harbour it was in. Was it Trondheim or somewhere in Norway, And so we were immediately roped in on the very day when we qualified to join with the Hood and set off in, to chase and possibly to come, catch up with the Bismarck and the Prince Eugen, because it had got this a cruiser with it called the Prince Eugen. And of course we went out and it was dark and sometimes the weather wasn't very brilliant, and we found very soon that we could leave our own destroyers behind in terms of speed, which told you something about the speed of the Prince when it was on the full steam. We were probably very pleased about that it was so quick. And of course, within a couple of days.
Can I just ask, were you seasick at all ever?
No.
You didn't get seasick?
No.
A couple of days and you meet them, don't you?
Yes, a couple of days. You see, they'd crept up around northern Iceland, between Iceland and Greenland. They came back down there and they passed or you could say the Dorsetshire and the, which other was it? There was another cruiser of ours was there and realised that those two ships probably, actually, they gave us the reports of where exactly where they were going. Well, why they didn't take on the Bismarck didn't take them on. Perhaps they would have given them away altogether then, where they were, especially if they'd got damaged. But especially if the German ships had got damaged. But eventually, of course, they came down through past Iceland, and we, of course, made towards them as quickly as we could. And started to shadow them.
Now, were you at your action stations in the forward transmitting system?
Yes, all the time. We were there a long time at action stations.
So, of course, the battle that followed, you would not see.
No,
at all.
Not at all. No, and of course the great big shock. The great big shock, of course, was after. I ought to tell you a bit. We waited because on the hood was the. I can't remember his name. The senior admiral, on the hood. Can't remember his name. But of course, everything that the hood did, because he was on the hood, then they determined the timing. Now, I mean, being in the transmitting station, I knew. And the difficulty was, and is in a sense, not to talk about what I knew that other people didn't know.
What do you mean? Sorry.
Well, we were held up by the fact that the hood didn't get a sighting by any means at all, of the Bismarck and the Prince Eugen until quite a long time after we did. I mean, I may be exaggerating, it may have been seconds, but to me, and I'm sure to others, it must have seemed an age.
You were unable. You had a fix on the range and could have opened fire.
Yes.
But you were waiting for the hood to gain a fix.
And when the hood got one, it got one, I think, in mistake on the Prince Eugen instead of on the Bismarck. You must check. Don't think that I know more than other people about all this. I mean, I just this is what I remember, and so it may be incorrect.
No, we quite understand.
And so we were waiting for the permission as second, to the admiral on the hood to open fire. And I always wondered what was the protocol, and I always, this is funny for me to be saying this, because I mean it's not my job really, always wondered if they got things right, and I could never understand why they didn't pick the prince to have the admiral on board as the, the leading ship.
It was a battleship as opposed to a battle cruiser.
Yes, that's right. I know there were things for and against, I'm sure, and perhaps people trusted the old hood rather than the new prince, really.
So to you, the Prince of Wales should have opened fire as soon as it got the range.
Yes.
That's what you... You're accepting.
Well,
it's nothing
I think
to do with you, but I mean, it's
no,
just
that's
what
right.
You thought.
I mean, that might have been fatal for us. I mean, it might have invited both ships to fire back and blow us out of the water. But of course, we were the armor on board the Prince was I think 4 inch thick. The whole of the citadel, in which the TS was down in the bottom. I mean, it was 4 inches thick all the way round, I believe. Whereas on the hood it was probably relatively thin, and of course it, there were lots of other things. The hood was probably lower, and there were other things against, you know.